So today we have an article from the Sydney Morning Herald, and this article is going to discuss the documentaries that have come out recently about Jeffrey Epstein and his criminal organization. Those documentaries, obviously, are Filthy Rich and Who Killed Jeffrey Epstein. Now, I'm sure everybody who is listening to this podcast has watched both of those already. If you have not, I highly suggest you do. You're not going to learn anything new, but again, you know how I feel about context and adding a little bit more meat to the bone. So today's article is going to talk about both of those documentaries. And this article is from the Sydney Morning Herald. And the headline is, Life of Jeffrey Epstein Leaves Viewer Feeling Grubby, Queasy, and Angry. That headline right there certainly is a bullseye, because that's the emotion it elicits from people who watch these documentaries, especially people who come in unaware as to what was really going on. They watch these documentaries and their head starts to spin and they start to ask themselves all of the questions that you asked yourself when you first heard all of this. And the cycle continues. But now people are starting to become a lot more aware of exactly what Jeffrey Epstein was, exactly what Jeffrey Epstein and his co-conspirators were up to. And they are also becoming aware that, like usual, they have been misled by those in power. This article was authored by Debbie Enker. The life of billionaire Jeffrey Epstein, pedophile, was laden with luxury. He owned a multi-story townhouse in Manhattan, an apartment in Paris, a ranch in New Mexico, an island in the Caribbean, a private jet. Yet for all its opulence, Epstein's world was an ugly place. A corrupt and exploitive environment where girls were routinely sexually abused. Spending time in the world of the financier, pedophile, as two recent documentaries do, is likely to leave a viewer feeling grubby, queasy, and angry. Look, there is zero doubt that if you had no idea who or what Jeffrey Epstein is or was, and then you got a full frontal the way that some of these documentaries are leading people in, of course it's going to shock the senses, right? To any normal person, this sort of thing is just beyond the pale. How something like this could have occurred, how he got off, how these girls were continuously treated like shit by the system. See, folks, because most people are decent, right? I refuse to believe that everybody or a majority of people out there are evil or just don't care or anything like that. I don't believe that. What I do believe is that people are caught up in their own lives most of the time, and they don't know what's going on around them if it doesn't directly affect them. So once they get hit in the face with something like this and their eyes open, I think most people care. And that's where, again, we have to throw a shot at the legacy media. It is their job to educate the masses about these kind of situations. It is their job to make sure the public understands just exactly what is going on and just exactly what is at stake. But they can't find the time to do that ever. Instead, they have to be involved in the tribalism. They have to be involved in the political nonsense, as opposed to exposing the biggest child trafficking ring, perhaps in the United States history. At the very least, the most high profile. But Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich on Netflix, and Who Killed Jeffrey Epstein on the ID channel, two quite different productions, also demonstrate why streaming services have become such an important home for documentaries. That's true, too. I've talked about this a lot on the podcast about how social media and these new platforms are huge tools to use in cases like this, because what it does is it exposes people who might not otherwise have been exposed to what's the information that is within the documentary or around the case. Because again, the legacy media does not do their job. So what happens? People swoop in and they fill the void, right? You have independent content creators, you have filmmakers, you have writers, etc., etc., that fill the void and do the job of the legacy media. Can you imagine if the legacy media paid this story the attention that it deserved? How many people would be enraged? Epstein died in August last year, soon after being taken from his cell in New York's Metropolitan Correctional Center, the official verdict being suicide, allegedly. Yet his story lives on, and not just because the circumstances of his death have proved fertile ground for conspiracy theories. Well, let me ask you a question, okay? How is it a conspiracy theory to demand answers when none are forthcoming? How is it a conspiracy theory when two guards fall asleep while they're on duty? The camera is pointed at the wrong tier. The camera does not record what it's supposed to record. The evidence ends up missing. How is that a conspiracy theory? That is not a conspiracy theory. What we have here, folks, is a cover-up. The sordid story has a range of reliability intriguing elements. Reliably intriguing elements. Sex, class, and powerful people. It's also about the protective cloak that money can buy. And again, when we talk about just scratching the surface, that is exactly what a statement like that is. Because sure, money definitely played a part here. Wealth definitely played a part here. But what really played a part was influence. What really played the biggest part, the most significant part here, was the peddling of information. Remember, the most important currency to these people is information. As both shows attest, the money man was a master manipulator who wormed his way into the upper echelons of business and society with well-connected English socialite, co-conspirator, co-abuser, Ghislaine Maxwell by his side. Despite a conviction in Florida in 2008 for procuring an underage girl for prostitution, doesn't even exist, an underage girl cannot consent, etc., etc., and allegations of financial misdeeds, he hobnobbed with political leaders and corporate barons, with scientific, academic, and technology chiefs, and with a prince who enjoyed his hospitality and largesse. Yeah. Jeffrey Epstein had a very, very, very large and vast circle of very powerful people who moved within its hallways. Jeffrey Epstein was considered a friend by these people. Jeffrey Epstein was invited to all of the functions with these people. And these people are going to act like they had no idea what was going on. Even after the fact that the man was arrested the first time and charged with what he was charged with, these people still opened the door and invited him back to polite society. Guys like Jess Staley, guys like Les Wexner, guys like Glenn Dubin. All of these people played a part in bringing Epstein back into so-called polite society without any of the stink of his crimes left on him. They acted as Febreze, basically. Meanwhile, with the help of accomplices, including Maxwell, who disappeared after his arrest, he lured girls and young women to his home with offers of payment for massages, sometimes sweetened by promises of educational or employment opportunities. And that's the carrot that was always dangled, right? These young girls from disadvantaged homes, broken homes, bad, bad situations. Well, the carrot that was dangled in front of them was, hey, we'll help you get a better job. Or, hey, we'll help you get educated. We'll help you get out of that piss poor environment that you're in. But just, you know, come along with us and do what we say. And of course, these young disadvantaged girls, they're saying to themselves, hey, this might be my out. I finally have a way to get out of this madness and make my life better. So they go with Jeffrey Epstein. They go with Ghislaine Maxwell. They go with Sarah Kellen Vickers, whoever it may be. They get to Epstein's house and the grooming process begins. And before you know it, they think that that's just the way things are in that kind of environment, in that sort of society. So they just go right along with it, and that is exactly the Jeffrey Epstein plan. That is exactly the plan that Ghislaine Maxwell used. Their blueprint is obvious here. Many of these girls were vulnerable. A predator hunts for the weakest, says lawyer Spencer Coovin, who represents women that Epstein molested. And that's always the case with people like this. These people like Jeffrey Epstein, they know they can't do this to one of their banker friend's daughters, right? Because, well, there would be repercussions. But to poor people, people that they look at as less than, well, we're just chattel to them. We're not even human beings. So why would it elicit any sort of remorse on their part for molesting these girls or hurting these girls? Because again, remember folks, we're not dealing with normal people here. We're dealing with people who are operating in a world of narcissism and a world of hubris that we cannot even begin to imagine. Inspired by the book by James Patterson, the aptly titled Filthy Rich succinctly illustrates the class divide with a bridge that literally separates the haves from the have-nots. And again, if you have not grown up poor, if you haven't grown up in the shadow of wealth hanging over you while you live in squalor, then you don't understand. I can't explain it to you. I cannot explain to you what it's like. But when you don't have anything and you see all of these people with stuff and then you have an opportunity to perhaps join their ranks, it is an opportunity that you cannot pass up. And these young girls, that was the dangling carrot for them. And it was a very, very powerful tool for Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. And it remains a powerful tool for these other networks that are still in operation, that are still being run brazenly. On the island of Palm Beach in Florida, the wealthy live in waterfront mansions. Across the Blue Heron Bridge, and as local writer Carl Hyacin notes, a world away in West Palm Beach is a working-class community of rundown houses and trailer parks where many of the girls lived. And these people knew that it was going to be a lot easier to manipulate these girls from disadvantaged homes as opposed to a girl from, say, a solid middle class, upper middle class background, or one of their golfing buddy type friends, right? That's not going to happen because you don't have the carrot to dangle at them. They don't need your money. So why would they come over and massage your disgusting old ass? So again, it is poor people who are once again used as nothing more than pawns for the elite. The documentaries differ notably in approach and style. Who Killed Jeffrey Epstein is tabloid TV fare that feels like it's yelling at you. It introduces itself with the narrator's declaration that this is the most twisted story of the decade. Its true crime scenario presented in a blaring, breathless tone. Sensationalized, adorned with thumping music, featuring repetitive recapping after anticipated ad breaks and dramatized recreation sequences. When interviewees describe the dire conditions at the prison where Epstein was incarcerated, we are shown images of rats scuffling down a dank corridor. And again, folks, I don't buy any of that, by the way, okay? As bad as the MCC is condition-wise, it's not like this is a place where suicides are happening on a regular basis, especially where Jeffrey Epstein was being held. So don't let them push that narrative down your throat. It makes me mad when they act like suicide is just such a common thing at MCC. Sure, it happens relatively often in the federal prison system as a whole, but at the MCC, it's just not true. It's not something we see on a regular basis at the MCC. Made as a three-part series for cable TV, but screening here at feature length, it charts Epstein's career in finance, the moneyed men he'd worked for, and network he built. It then moves on to the views about his death, airing theories about him being a spy and possessing audio and video recordings of people's indiscretions that could be used for blackmail. Well, we know that's a fact. We know for a fact that Jeffrey Epstein was compiling dossiers on people. We know that he was compiling information on people. And we know what he told Virginia to do while she was doing what he made her do. So we know for a fact that the whole blackmail angle of this is true. And we also know that he was not working in a vacuum. He wasn't just compiling these dossiers. They were doing something with them. And where this information going, where this information would end up, well, that is the million-dollar question. That is where the speculation comes in. But from where I'm sitting, there is only one possible answer to that. And my friends, it is a three-letter organization that has its fingers in many pies. And just look around the world, and wherever something is going south, you can be sure the CIA is not far behind. A couple of forensic pathologists find that his fatal injuries were consistent with homicide rather than suicide. And that there have been a lot of questions surrounding that, right? All we have is the state coming out and giving us their report, right? What they said happened. Meanwhile, they haven't shown any evidence to back it up. It's just, once again, like Bill Barr says, well, just believe what I have to tell you. In reality and in the real world, none of us are willing to do that at this point. The four-part Filthy Rich features a range of people who do not appear in the other production, from women abused by Epstein to police, journalists, authors, and lawyers involved with the case. Directed by Lisa Bryant, it eschews a sensational tone as it quietly, clinically constructs its portrait. And the Filthy Rich documentary, as you know, is a lot of it is testimony from some of the survivors. And that's what makes it such a powerful documentary, right? In my opinion, Filthy Rich was much better than Who Killed Jeffrey Epstein and much more of a resource for people who are just getting involved with the case. So, as I've stated earlier, I believe that Filthy Rich most certainly did what it set out to do by being a basic entry point for people who have not really followed this case. A large part of its focus is on the women who Epstein abused, identifying them as survivors rather than victims. That's right, because that's what they are. They are survivors, not victims. And I'm glad that all these other outlets are starting to fall into line and starting to take notice of the proper labeling of these gals. They aren't victims anymore. They're now survivors, courageous survivors who are fighting back with everything in their arsenal to bring justice down around the heads of these disgusting animals who abused them for so long and who were protected by the media and some in the government. It allows space for their stories to be told and their voices to be heard. Their pain is palpable as they detail their fears, regrets, anguish, and shame. They are both courageous and fragile. Some reveal lifelong damage. Well, even the ones who don't reveal it, I'm sure, have very, 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 very dark thoughts at times, because you can't live through trauma like this and have it not reoccur in your dreams and subconsciously come back. And that's why something like this is so horrible. That's why something like this cannot go unchallenged. That's why people like Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel and the rest of them must be brought to justice. Possibly, as there's no narration to deploy as a linking device, there are too many cliched shots of various women staring out to sea. But the anger they convey is justified because it took so long for any kind of justice to be achieved. Negotiated by a brigade of high-profile lawyers, the 2008 Miami conviction is persuasively and shockingly depicted as a sweetheart deal. After Epstein was arrested last year in New Jersey, his death robbed the women of their chance to confront him in court. Depicted as a sweetheart deal? I got news for you, Sydney Morning Herald. This was the sweetheart deal of all sweetheart deals. This is the kind of deal that the mafia would have gotten in the old days if they would have had a couple of jurors over the barrel. You don't get this kind of deal just by negotiating. There is a lot more here, and until we can see those grand jury records, until we can see what truly occurred, then I am still never, ever going to believe the official narrative. They need to prove it at this point. Filthy Rich helps to illustrate why documentaries have become such a key yet unexpected part of the streaming revolution, which has granted them a new lease on life. One of the early surprises of SVOD viewing patterns was not that people were flocking to big-budget showpieces such as The Crown, but the popularity of back catalog series such as Friends and The Office. Now the nonfiction area is also proving a rich seam, especially valuable at a time when documentaries have been rare on free TV, with feature-length productions virtually non-existent. And that's definitely true too, because documentaries play a huge part in cases like this, in my opinion. You know, just look at the ones that have come out prior to Filthy Rich, and look at the interest they drummed up. And then, in turn, look at the court cases that started again because of these documentaries. You see, at the end of the day, we have to remember, folks, we have the power. It is up to us, not them. They work for us. So if we exert the proper amount of pressure, if we hit the accelerator at the right time, and we make our voices heard, it'll be a real difficult challenge for them to ignore all of us. With one gnat, you can swat them away. 10 million gnats? Well, now you find yourself suffocating. Already this year, we've been treated to cleverly constructed and compelling series such as The Test, Amazon Prime, and The Last Dance on Netflix. Filthy Rich joins a group that demonstrates that the streaming services have allowed documentary makers the money and the latitude to display their accomplishment as storytellers. And again, Filthy Rich has its ups and downs, right? There's things about Filthy Rich that I would have changed. But at the same time, I understand that with a mere 4 hours, roughly, to tell the story, they had to be pretty locked in to what they wanted to get out there. They couldn't be veering off in other directions and leaving things, you know, threads untied, etc., etc. So for what Filthy Rich is and for what it set out to accomplish, I truly believe it has done a fantastic job. Just look at all the new interest in the case. That alone is worth its weight in gold, in my opinion. Because again, the more people involved, the louder our voice becomes and the harder justice will be to not happen, right? It'll be harder for them to deny justice to these girls if everybody is up in arms about this. The only way that we can hold them accountable is by holding those in power that we've elected or have been put in power by those we elected accountable as well. And if that means voting out everybody who was ever involved in something like this, then I say that's what we do. Because personally, I would have a hard time voting for anybody ever involved with Jeffrey Epstein at this point. That's how disgusted I am by this whole entire thing. That's how disgusting the whole entire thing is. And to be honest with you, the look behind the curtain into the dark room of what is truly going on at the highest levels of power leaves me sick to my stomach. But the contents of that room need to be laid bare for everybody to see, because unless this story is brought to the public, unless the veil of secrecy is lifted from the whole entire thing, then these sort of operations are just going to continue. And later on down the road, there will be another Jeffrey Epstein. And the whole entire cycle will repeat itself once again. If you'd like to contact me, you could do that at bobbycappucci@protonmail.com. That's BOBBYCAPUCCI at protonmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter at BOBBY_CAPUCCI. All right, folks. We'll